Hey everyone, welcome back to this course in Esoteric Christianity, and in this talk I will be talking about Meister Eckhart, who is probably one of the more familiar faces in this course. He's someone that many people have heard of. The Eckhartian theology of simplicity, this move within the 13th century towards a negative theology from Dionysius, which becomes far more practical, which enters into a contemplative meditation type entry towards God and what it is to be a Christian. And so this is actually one of the longer talks, but the slides are quite minimal because Eckhart's philosophy, theology, contemplative method really does align itself with a simple way of being, a simple way of approaching God, and this is really paramount for Eckhart. And it once again, it's one of these systems, not really a system, but it's one of these theologies and approaches, we could say, which really builds on itself to something with a very sort of strong coherence and a reason as to why the larger philosophy relates to the individual in their approach to God. So moving forward, with Eckhart, with speaking here about 1260 through to 1328, even though we don't have all that much detail, at least about his early life, because as many people will know, though I will touch on this, in his later life, Eckhart becomes somewhat of a controversial figure. Even though that is the case, as it stands in history, of course, we remember people near the end because they've written all this stuff and they become famous. But as it is... with the beginning, there's some, you know, we're not recording his life in detail with the knowledge that he is going to become the famous Meister Eckhart. But anyway, Eckhart lived from 1260 to 1328. He lived through then the high middle to late Middle Ages, an era of innovation, of consumerism of its own kind, and a lot of his work is responding to what is really an early form of consumerism within this move from the high middle to late Middle Ages. There's also a lot of nobility, a lot of prestige, and in a Christian sense, a development of a form of very external and extrovert pride, if we wanted to put it that way. And there is, within this day, a few who still believed in that very potent sense in what we could maybe consider an imminent eschatology, an end of days, that things are ending. And really, when you look at this throughout time, this... civilizations tend to go through sort of a ground, then they come up to a peak, in this case in Eckhart's day, with this sort of prestige, nobility, pride, consumerism. They go, the end is nigh, the end is nigh, and this repeats itself over and over and over again. But there is a potent strain of that form of very present end of days thinking within Eckhart's day, which is something to consider. But Eckhart, as I said, we don't have all that many details regarding his early life. He was most likely born between 1250 and 1260 in the Thuringian Landgraviate settlement of Tambach, close to Gotha. It was formerly said that he came from a wealthy, noble family. This is somewhat still the case. It's somewhat still appreciated that he came from a wealthy noble family, but this is based on somewhat of a incorrect interpretation of the records from the time. In actuality, not really all that much is known. I mean, it's considered, and if you read Joel Harrington's book on Eckhart, which is really, really brilliant and was one of my sources for the biography, he really grew up in what we could possibly consider, if we were talking very roughly, in a very comfortable middle-class household, if we were to put it in the context of our own days. His Christian name was Eckhart. His last name was von Hochheim, H-O-C-H-H-E-I-M. And there's no real reason to give him his the Christian name Johann, which occasionally appears in historical studies. We don't know much about his youth or his exposure to the wide world. He was a lesser noble. He would have had tutors and certain expectations made of him in relation to that consumerism, that sort of proto-modernity, that nobility, that notion of prestige, fashions, knights, money culture. And the gift-giving between the nobles are very, really, in the Christian sense, you know, the removal of humility, the removal of a certain humility regarding possessions, and he would have been educated regarding certain expectations concerning this form of lifestyle. So when we go through to his theology and his approach to the Christian way of life as a very, very, very practical thinker, we can see how he might have ruffled some feathers in the day. This is a background, of course, that he never really truly leaves behind in this sense. We see noble language in these notions make their way into his texts. But he loved chivalric romances, on the other hand. He loved Percival, the story of the Grail, Parzival. And he would have been imbued with notions of virtue and quest and journey. Of course, completely also imbued with references to concepts which are then very strongly rooted, such as heaven, soul, redemption. You know, this is a part in history where the Christian tradition, so to speak, is really in full steam. He most likely enrolled at the Erfurt Dominican convent in 1278, so just when he was 18, if we've got the dates of his birth correct. And he is believed to have attended Cologne before 1280. Before or after his time in Cologne, he might have attended the University of Paris to further his education. So very early on, he's very serious about the religious life. As we don't know too much about his early life, you know, we don't have too much about whether or not, you know, what his opinion is towards vocation, how he approached all this. But he's very well educated. He's imbued within a certain culture. And very early on, he's going to convents and attending to the religious life. However, the first conclusive proof of his existence comes from the Easter sermon he delivered at the Dominican convent of Saint-Jacques in Paris on April 18th, 1294. So the first conclusive evidence of his existence is when he's 34 years old, while serving as a baccalaureus, a lecturer on the sentences of Peter Lombard. Now, the sentences by Peter Lombard is one of these texts which every person would basically tackle back in the day, so this isn't necessarily surprising. This position, he probably would have been appointed in 1293, and Eckhart was appointed the prior and the Dominican provincial of Thuringia before the end of 1294. So by his mid-30s, he's very seriously rooted as someone who clearly has the education and the tact and the ability to give talks. This period, 1295 to 1298, is when he produced his first vernacular work, Reden der Unterweisung, the Talks of Instruction, the Councils of Discernment, and a little bit of the Talks of Instruction comes in later. And really, this is a collection of lectures specifically given to Dominican novices, and this does come through in the way he talks about it, that like many Christian mystics, I think of St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila, They make it very clear these writings are meant for certain people, not necessarily in that esoteric sense of something hidden, but they were written with the Dominican novice in mind, or for Saint Teresa of Avila they were written with the Carmelite novice in mind. He's then transferred to Paris in 1302 to occupy the external Dominican chair of theology, and he stayed there till about 1303. So he returns to Erfurt in the later part of 1303. He's appointed the provincial superior for Saxony, a very fairly large region, and he was then in charge of 47 convents in that area, so he's a fairly big name. The Aymeric of Piacenza, the general, appointed him as his vicar general for Bohemia the following year, with full authority to restore order to the demoralized monasteries there. And at this point, a few little things begin to arise about him and the way he approaches things. But at this point, they're not all that sort of drastic. He's then appointed as a teacher in Paris in 1311 by the general chapter meeting held in Naples. The only other person to have received what is this extremely rare invitation to return to Paris for a second term was Thomas Aquinas. So from this we can see that he is among the ranks of people who clearly were understood as someone who can truly convey the Christian message in a very serious, serious sense. Around this time, certain Dominican officials were already being troubled, as I said, by his philosophy, speaking out against what they said, friars in Teutonia who speak things in their sermons that can easily lead simple and ignorant people into mistake. So this was from the Dominican General Chapter, which gathered in 1325, really referencing Eckhart, saying that there's certain things that are being said in these sermons which could lead people astray, perhaps because of the symbolism, perhaps because of the abstractness, perhaps because of the extent which maybe Eckhart talks about sin, which we'll get to. Now, Nicholas of Strasbourg, to whom the Pope had delegated control of the Dominican converts in 1325, may have been motivated by this worry to look into Eckhart's orthodoxy. Then Eckhart was given a list of questionable sections from the Book of Consolation by Nicholas. So Eckhart responded with the now lost dissertation, Requiescatus, which reassured his immediate superiors. He's basically like, look, okay, I am orthodox, you know, don't worry, I'm not going too far. However, in spite of this problem, the Archbishop ordered an inquisitorial trial in 1326. Basically, once again, Eckhart then writes another document outlining everything he had learned. He does have the full support of his superiors throughout this time. There's just all these inquests and inquisitions, but not in the sort of the Inquisition sense where people are getting tortured or pinned down or anything like this. This is really, look, should you really be where you are? There was just a bit of vagueness. And the notion that Eckhart was this super, super controversial figure, that he had to go before the Pope, as is emphasized in Harrington's biography, there isn't as much truth with regards to like the dramatics of that as people would like to make out. You know, he's not on the run. He's not really having his stuff burned. He's not possibly going to get burned at the stake. It's really an inquest regarding, look, where are you going with this? How far, how orthodox is this? So 1327, Eckhart delivered a sermon in the Dominican church in Cologne before the Archbishop's inquisitors, and they handed down their verdict. He then had his secretary give out a public declaration of his innocence. He protested, saying that he had always hated anything that was wrong, and that should anything of that sort be discovered in his writings, he would then withdraw them. Which his intended audience were the general people, and Eckhart would make his work sort of clear for laity, for everyday people. And this is probably one of the reasons that it was a bit sort of dubious, and there was a lot of hoo-ha around you know, what he was doing and who he was and what he was undertaking, because, well, he's speaking to the everyday people, and as I said earlier, he might lead them astray and all this sort of stuff. Around this time, the decision really seemed to be against Eckhart because of this controversy. But Eckhart, once again, he argues against the decision by denying the inquisitors and the archbishop's competence and power, and then he leaves, you know, this sort of typical medieval thing where people run off and leave and, like, they have to be found or whatever. Then Pope John the 22nd appears to have established two tribunals, one of theologians and the other of cardinals, in Avignon to conduct an investigation into the matter. Seems all very serious, but from reading around this, once again with Harrington's work, which is really one of the more contemporary researches into Eckhart's life and contemporary biographies, we find that, there just seems to be maybe a bit of a twist of the arms, like, you need to look into this, but it's not sort of this, if all goes bad, then Eckhart's going to be killed or anything like that. There is then, you know, a long defense. It's known that the commission regarding this narrowed all these suspect articles that they had down to 100, from 150 suspect things that Eckhart had written down to 28. The Pope then informs the Archbishop that the case against Eckhart was progressing, but added that Eckhart had already passed away, so not much really happened with it. So basically, this was all underway, and then Eckhart dies. Current research suggests that he may have passed away on January 28th, 1328. So the judgment regarding this committee against Eckhart was supported by papal commission, but it didn't really get full steam ahead because, well, Eckhart had already passed away. So then in 1329, the Pope published a bill in which he condemns a number of Eckhart's assertions as heretical and accused others maybe of possibly being so. And the conclusion states that Eckhart submitted himself and his book to the apostolic seals judgment before his death and retracted what he had erroneously taught. It's probable that the Pope's unprecedented choice to issue the bill, notwithstanding Eckhart's passing, was motivated by pressure from someone else and his concern over the rise of mystical heresy, people entering into a very overt personal mysticism and teaching other people. So there really was pressure from elsewhere regarding the Pope, regarding this matter. And it all, in a sense, reading about it, it all somewhat disappointingly in a way, falls a bit flat because Eckhart dies before anything can happen. And then there's this classic, well, he retracted anything that was wrong on his deathbed. St. Augustine also does this and says, you know, I'm now dying. Look, anything, I hand over everything to God. And Eckhart retracts everything. So it's sort of like, oh, okay, well, he died before anything could really happen, but nothing was really going to happen anyway. But he's still, there's still this sort of burgeoning rumors around the controversy of Eckhart, so to speak. In the modern Catholic Church, however, Eckhart's standing has been murky because of this. In the waning years of the 20th century, the Dominican order pushed for his total recovery and the affirmation of his theological orthodoxy. Pope John Paul II expressed support for this endeavour and even quoted from Eckhart's writings. But all of this was sort of kept away. And Eckhart just remains one of these names where you might find a compilation of his works and you might find people who are more esoterically Christian-minded who find him. And he isn't really contained within either camp too much now, because within completely Orthodox theology, they still have to deal with the fact of this sort of controversy around his work and then this historical context of just how far did he go? Did he go a bit too wrong? But then in the esoteric camp, well, he's still really got one real clear foot with regard to his biography of being this Dominican superior and all this in the Orthodox theology of institutions. So he's sort of like straddling both camps, and no one, to a certain extent, I don't really think anyone still knows really knows what to do with him. But I would say now that the Vatican's fairly fine with him, but fine in the sense of we just don't really talk about him. And then, you know, he's slowly been defended all the way through to like Pope Benedict, and I would imagine these days with the rise of Pope Francis, he's more than well accepted. But that's a little introduction to the biography and the life of Eckhart, and really where he's coming from with respect to his own context. However, let's move through to his work, which is beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful work. And once again, I will have to move my camera around for you guys. So I've briefly covered his life there. And what I'll do is I'll begin with a general idea of his thought and then move through to specific readings relating to the sermons and to the extracts and bring back that biography and see why this might have all been so dubious. Beginning with Eckhart's theology and his mysticism, we might wish to understand a single, quite coincidentally, as you'll see, a single overarching principle. A concept which guides his entire thought, really, and underlines it or overlines it in a way. And we can, once again, if you've hopefully you're watching these in order, you can go back to Pseudo Dionysius. The concept is unicity, or you could call it harmony, but the common word that's used is oneness. So think of the difference between oneness and fragmentation. These are the two things to keep in mind with Eckhart at all times: oneness, fragmentation, unicity or multiplicity, which is to say that there is an ultimate principle of the universe that is single, that is one, and it's undivided. It is a unity. It is a oneness. And therefore, anything outside of this singular thing, this oneness, is fractured. This is the language that Eckhart would use. Is fractured and or multiple. Of course, we can see here connections to all kinds of Christian theology already. We can see connections to Pseudo Dionysius with respect to the notion of the light coming down and splitting into a multiple. But we can also see connections to schism, to the Reformation, which of course hadn't happened yet, but this notion of people splitting off in all these directions and perhaps fragmenting the oneness of the love of God within the church. And I think this is a very big thing for Eckhart, is to retain the simplicity of what it is we're striving towards. However, this principle or concept for Eckhart would be in relation with what is outside of it, really, and understood as fractured, which is to say that everything which is fractured and multiple is constantly looking backwards towards its source. So everything which is fractured has been fractured. So everything which is multiple, which is fractured and fragmented in a way, and schismed, it's always looking back to that absolute principle of the universe, the oneness, that everything exists in reference to the oneness it came from, to the singular thing, this one, God. And Eckhart doesn't always use the term God, surprisingly. Sometimes I think he's used the term absolute at times. Sometimes he'll just use one, as in, look, this is a singular thing. But God, it's obviously God. And everything exists in reference to this singular thing and is looking back to it both in presence and absence, in the sense that all things are multiple. Their fullness may be understood in relation to this singular thing, but there is still an understanding of its absence without fracturing the thing we've found. So both absence and presence in relation to the oneness, this ultimate principle of oneness. And of course we can look at the work of the Neoplatonists to understand that in what we've already seen in the work of Dionysius, for instance, in relation to the hierarchy, the singular oneness, often known in other areas of thought. So for the Neoplatonists, it would be, well, for Plato, it would be the one. Then certain Neoplatonists might even call it the absolute. Pseudo-Dionysius would consider God as that over, beyond, 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 beyond. So the fragmentation of it's we could draw in that Neoplatonic tradition and realize that from this dualism, it's the oneness of above is coming down and then it fragments, and then what we have in the world below, in the fragmented thing, the multiplicity, is something which is fragmented and not whole and not part of the oneness in an absence. So it's present, but its fullness is with regards to an absence in relation to the fact it's always looking back to that oneness which it came from. So once we can now begin to draw in Eckhart into that previous tradition and understand that from oneness to fragmentation is applicable to that hierarchy. And for Eckhart, the most adequate and accessible way of speaking of God as this singular thing, as this notion of the one, that is the best way to think about God, is because we can draw in Pseudo-Dionysius and Eckhart together here, that Pseudo-Dionysius, in the respect of his the divine names, right, well, when you're referring to God, you've got to be careful because God can't simply be something, he has to be beyond it because he's beyond all things, he's beyond the hierarchy altogether, so he's over good, over beauty, etc., etc., or pre-good, pre-beauty. And for Eckhart, we can think about it in this sense that the most adequate way to think about God as this singular thing, the notion of the one, of oneness itself, and in the sense it's oneness itself, it can be no singular thing that we find. We can't say that, once again, into this notion of apophatic negative theology, we can say that no singular thing that we find, that beautiful sunset, for instance, or that singular good act, that can't be God in itself because it's fragmented from the oneness. And so in the sense that this is the most accessible way to think about God, is how do you return to that fullness? How do you return to that oneness? And for Eckhart, the notion of oneness seems to capture something about God's essence in language, which we can then practically use in our approach towards him. Once again, there's an underlying strain within esoteric Christianity of moving away from pure dogmatics towards, all right, well, what are we doing here? It's not in the selfish, individualistic sense, but in the sense of, if we are to be something, what is it that we have to do to move towards God? And even in the sense of the plurality of the Holy Trinity, because we think, well, God is one. What about the Holy Trinity? What about the splitting that I spoke about in the theology talk? Eckhart places this oneness of God as the Trinity, as a unified nature above the Trinity. One of his more controversial moves. But with that said, anyone who does fairly intricate research into Trinitarian investigations and research throughout history will notice that a lot of people have had real, the Trinity is one of the places, it's the key place, as we'll know from the heresies talk, the key place where most of heresies and most of people go, and what do we do with this? What do we do with three natures that are singular? You know, what do we do with all this? And Eckhart places the oneness of God as the Trinity, as a unified nature, above the Trinity. And this could bring about questions, of course, as to how that something that is unified in nature can get a son. How can a oneness have a son, which would then seem like a fragmentation, and therefore assume a sense of plurality? But for Eckhart, this relates to God as the Father, distinctly as the Father, and therefore having him within the Father an inherent fertility, and thus paternally produces the Son within that singular oneness of that inherent fertility. So it remains within the Trinity as a singular, because he's saying, well, if the most adequate way to talk about God is a oneness, what about when he fragmented into three parts? Once again, this is a reconciliation of Neoplatonism, Christian doctrine, with respect to how do we deal with this whole filtering thing of things coming down. Now, in moving towards this oneness, in practically speaking, in the esoteric terms, with respect to what do we really do about ourselves, there's always this split between the above and the below, with ourselves being not fully of the above and not fully of the below, with a mediating animal who lives on the world but has that singular part within us. When we move towards this oneness, Eckhart begins to talk about a emphasis on creatures and ourselves as creatures, and creatures as obviously part of creation. Creation coming down, God's creation, creation of oneness. So the act of creation is a fragmentation through to singular fragmented creatures. The problem, and that's in a sense, we could say that's the fall as well. The fall, metaphorically speaking, is fragmentation from the singular goodness. We can go back to Pseudo-Dionysius, singular light fragmented into rays. The problem for Eckhart, and the thing which he finds peculiar, as did many other thinkers of his day, is that creation couldn't take place within time, since time itself didn't pre-exist before the created order. Creation, and therefore the act of creation, happens from that oneness, from a thing which is outside of time. And so in getting closer to God as his creation, creation taking place outside of time, so us as creations, part of creation, but who are in time, and to get close to God as creator, which is outside of time, we are urged by Eckhart to attempt to attain knowledge of that which exists in the mind of God, and move ourselves therefore away from temporal and spatial things itself, and largely of course those things which are temporal, which also have to be spatial. And this is a slight lean towards the notion of negative theology, removing everything away. But for Eckhart, he begins really from that sense of oneness, multiplicity. But if the oneness, which is God as creator, was outside of time, before creation, which is in time, then those creations, creatures, which are within time, need to move towards things which are not of space and time, to move towards that which is of God, which is a very pure and strange way of talking about negative theology, of removing to get towards God, even to the point of removing anything which is in space and time. So for Eckhart, in this sense, however, is a peculiar notion of understanding ourselves as borrowing our creaturely nature, borrowing our very existence, because the created world and all things, of course, look back towards the oneness. And in that sense, they remain with God as they look back. And so that which we as creatures, as part of creation, have inherited is merely something we have borrowed from God. So it's not the case of a oneness, which is God, and then fragmentation, and then there's like a cut. So we're little fragmented things. Back to the Dionysian light. The light is spread out, but we are still of that oneness. So in looking back, we are both looking back towards God and trying to find a way to approach him. But we're also realizing we are still of that thing, and we are borrowing our creaturely nature from God, from God's will, which upholds all things. And this, in a sense, is one of the most extreme forms of negative theology, because we realize not only do we not have possessions in the world, these things are borrowed from God, but to a certain degree, in a very real degree, we don't even have a possession of a self, because we borrowed our creaturely nature from God. So once again, the notion of all which is fractured has its foundation with God, rays of light going back to the oneness of light and the will of God. And this is where Eckhart's language of oneness and unification allows us to understand the concept of being drawn back to a unification of a unified thing. Now, this is one of the first cases in the history of what we're talking about as esoteric Christianity, where we see the interplay between intellect, emotions, and the body, a trio which begins to take much greater emphasis in post-Reformation modern esotericists. But beginning now with Eckhart and his understanding of the soul, he tells us that it's the intellect that makes the image of God, and the intellect bears no likeness to anything else. It is pure and it is unmixed, and this notion relates to certain other ideas of something being higher than other things, a higher intellect which connects to the soul, something higher. And it goes back once again to that notion of hierarchy, and then we can bring through this notion of there being a major hierarchy, which actually goes through to the individual, though Eckhart isn't as explicit about this, but an individual hierarchy where something at the top of our own hierarchy, we have body, we have the body, we have the emotions, we have the intellect, we have the soul, of course, is what is the higher thing in ourselves, which then links ourselves to the higher in the sense of a macro-micro mirror, in a way. And for Eckhart, it is quite literally this intellect and thus the image of God that is higher than the angels. It has a relationship with the notion of scale, wherein something that is seated higher can bring something else down while simultaneously bringing ourselves up away from the fractured reality. So that higher thing within ourselves, which is towards the oneness, closer to God, is in itself more unfractured. It's moving away from what are the most fractured things around us. Senses, you know, firstly, look at how fractured this reality is. There's loads of individual things, loads of individual ideas, senses, sense impressions, emotions. We need to move towards away from that. We think back to Dionysius as moving away from all those layers of reality in the Neoplatonic tradition. Now, soul, something higher to God, this brings in the most probably well-known Eckhartian notion. Because when most people think of Eckhart, they'll go, isn't he the guy that spoke of the divine spark? And often when we hear of Eckhart for the first time, we people will say, ah, yeah, the divine spark. Okay, this thing for Eckhart, which was the divine image, which is within all of us as a potentiality, a transcendent potentiality from which the soul may or may not enjoy the unity with God. And so in relation to highest seat of the intellect, we're talking about the divine spark, which is the thing within us which we could consider the top of, speaking symbolically, top of a certain individual micro hierarchy, which then relates to that macro hierarchy and draws us up to God away from creation. It's the oneness within ourselves. And Gurdjieff, later on, I always speak of him because all of these things solidify throughout time. Many and other thinkers will utilize this notion as how to have that oneness. The intellect, then, in this sense for Eckhart, is therefore one, and the soul in its essence and God are one, because the soul as that once again, back to that ray of light, the ray of light as the fragmentation, as giving the divine spark, is still the ray in itself. So the sense of having the soul is, I always point to the chest, I don't really know why, with the soul is something already within that frame. So if we go back to the Platonic split, the above, the below, the divine things, the worldly things, the soul is the strange thing which is below but above. Because it's already within, it's part of the divine world. The soul, as understood as God's breath, is part of the divine world which has been encapsulated within a worldly vessel. And so it's that thing that we need to go towards, which will bring us higher, but in the sense that we can't allow that thing to be sort of composted with fragmentation or suffocated with fragmentary things of the world. Now, this isn't to say that we are God, or that this is anything to do with the Gnostic notion of the divine spark, but merely to emphasize for Eckhart that the foundational aspect of using the language of oneness and unification is an understanding of is to begin with an understanding of ourselves in connection to God. Divine pieces of the oneness which have been fragmented away, which to look back, once again looking back towards the oneness, those things in themselves are that oneness. So when we look back, we move away, we push all the way at the spatial temporal things of the sensual world, the worldly world, and then we look back towards as something which is already part of that oneness but has been fragmented. And that's the way for Eckhart to think about ourselves. This brings forth the question, of course, as to what is the relationship between the individual and God in the work of Eckhart. How is it exactly that one comes to know God when we have all this, well, we've now got this foundation, we've got this oneness, we've got this fragmentation, we've got the seat of the intellect, we've got all these different things. We have the soul in relation to oneness in this act of connection. We have also this notion of negative theology and how it is we might finally realize God's immediacy within our lives and realize the kingdom which is within us. And for Eckhart, this is to do with the image of the birth of God in the soul. Back to the notion in the Trinity of fertility. How is it that there's there? How is it that the Trinity as fragmented into a trio, that's not really a fragmentation for Eckhart, how can it be though that there's the three singular things as a oneness, which is the great Trinity problem of the Trinity, right? Three and three as one. Three literally as one, not three as three and then contained, but three as still singular, is to do with an inherent capacity for fertility within the Father, which that fertility itself is still within the oneness. And for Eckhart, this birth of the Son, that is to say Jesus Christ within our lives, is relation to the birth of the relatable God-man, Jesus Christ the Son, within the human soul, which outlines the possibility of ourselves to enter the narrow path. So the inherent fertility within the oneness, which is the oneness, even as fragmented, is of course still the oneness, as we understood from Pseudo-Dionysius. A singular ray from the oneness is still in its essence the oneness itself. So within the divine spark, you know, a spark starts a fire. It's the inherent fertility that is within the Father, which allows Jesus Christ, the Son, as the kingdom of God. The kingdom of God is within you. The inherent fertility of the Father as the birth of Jesus Christ within your internal life is within you. So the Son, referred to as the Word, which is to say Jesus Christ is the Word of God. So as Jesus himself is born within our inner lives, so too is the Word. So to encapsulate all of that, it seems tough to do, but we can get there. Beginning with a oneness, and the oneness as God contains the Trinity. Now within the Trinity is the problem of how can the Trinity split? Father, Son, Holy Spirit. As we will know from the theology, Father gives birth to the Son. Their infinite love between them as reciprocal gives birth to the Holy Spirit. Now, that inherent fertility of the Father, which gives birth to the Son, in its oneness as a ray into the soul, the ray from the oneness, the fragmentation of a ray of light in its essence as still the oneness, as the divine spark, which is our soul, contains that inherent potentiality of fertility, of giving birth to Christ within our lives. Christ is the Word of God, so as Christ is born within us, as the kingdom of God is within us, so too is the Word. And it's from this ability of Eckhart, of language, that without the Word, the inner kingdom, in relation to this higher seat of the intellect, with all this potentiality that the Word is born within us, and Eckhart shows how that is from his concept of oneness, the character of God is born within ourselves, and it's not an intellectual birth, but it's a transcendent birth with something more in the intellect, the Word within the intellect, which then brings us beyond these things and in an immediate connection with God. And so this notion of the birth is thus an overcoming of the scale within us here and now holds a central place because it allows for the reunification of our fragmented divine spark with the oneness. Sort of a transcendence and immanence. And it's a real encapsulation of what it is to be that media in-between creature and how we as individuals begin going towards God. Of course, it brings forth another question. Of moving towards God, there is of course the question of how it was we became to be detached, what the fall is in relation with this communication. How can this inner voice move away from God and move away from the communication which will be born within us towards Christ? And what Eckhart leans on here is a concept which he calls detachment, meaning being cut off from, because ultimately we have opened up this channel of communication by the grace of God, allowing for the birth of the divine spark within us. And still there is still something clearly which cuts off our oneness. You don't simply go, the word of Jesus is born within me, that I know the word of God, and we're now one in the sense of maybe the seventh castle in Teresa of Avila. There's still something that clearly cuts us off as fragmented creatures from this complete oneness. And ultimately, for Eckhart, this is one of the same as many other people, that the freedom of the enlightened soul is a freedom from the attachment of the things of the world. So as we enter into that relationship of moving back towards the oneness and allowance of the birth of the word, the birth of Christ is the birth of the word within us in our intellect, which then moves towards the higher things, we're still detached in the sense that we're part of the world and we have to enact that apophatic theology of pushing things away. So it's not a complete liberation in a strictly orthodox ascetic sense of like a moral liberation, but it's a liberation of the intellect which can move itself away from the fragmented worldly things, a cognitive freedom which allows us a further liberation from the passions and the appetites, and in the sense that the intellect as the higher seat forms images of things and begins to de-identify and detach itself via its cognitive ability to listen to the word within us. And it's always making that decision of the higher and the lower. So that is a creature and creation, of how the creature moves, the creature of creation moves towards its creator. So as we enter further specifics of Eckhart's theology and ideas, we will just keep going back towards this notion of oneness and the notion of negative theology of, in oddly, as you move away more and more things, you move back to the singular, the unity. The first is another thing to talk about is beginning with Eckhart's talks of instruction, some of the first things he wrote for the Dominican novices. And we do need to emphasize the fact that they were written for novices, but beginning with the talks of instruction, the idea that for something to enter into us, to allow something to be born with us, there can't be anything in that quote-unquote space already. So it's all very well for Eckhart to try allow God to move into us, to allow that birth to really take underway, but there has to be a clear space. There has to be something empty there for there has to be space for God, basically. And so his negative theology is sort of reciprocal. You clear away so something can enter. You can't be closer to God and still be the worldly person you are. You can't have both those decisions. So the idea of clearing a space so that God can enter into us is both reciprocally taking a leave of our own wealth, but also at the same time putting it in the hands of a superior. So it's a submission, and it's like a double submission. You submit to God by submitting all your stuff away. And if we no longer will anything for ourselves, then God must will on our behalf. So it's a case of constantly entering into that relationship where the word is born within us to give away our own will, but in that sense God's will moves towards us. And Tomberg, we'll talk about this much, much later on with the work of Tomberg. But we can think about this earlier on in the notion of what happens with Christ's temptation in the desert. Christ is tempted in the desert. The three great temptations. He's offered the world. He wants to do a miracle. And these three great temptations, he has to go through them first. He has to deny them first, say no to the devil three times. And then what happens? Then the angels appear to him. You can't have them both. You can't be, I might do these temptations. I might be tempted here. And then the angels come in, because it's light and darkness. Going back to Dionysius, going back to the symbols of what it is for the oneness in a way to come down as light. Light and darkness, they can't coexist. The darkness either is, or the light comes in and then the darkness is dispelled. So Christ had to deny the darkness first, and then the light can come in and dispel it. But you can't sit in the darkness and say, oh, I really like being in the dark. And then the light is also... You can't have light and darkness. You can't make that decision. So it's in this sense with Eckhart that we have to give up our own wills to allow for the will of God to enter into us. Now, this is the sense that we could talk about in the work of Eckhart, the notion of a free mind. Now, The modern notion of freedom to do what we want is actually not the thing. A free mind here, which is free to accept the truth, free to accept that true birth within us of the divine spark, and therein not be troubled or fettered by that which Eckhart would merely see as detritus or worldly. So free in the sense to constantly, but free to look back at oneness. Always, that's what a free mind would be. Not just open in the sense that anything enters into it, but free in the sense of focused on the singular truth of where it came from, the looking back to the oneness. Now, Eckhart could be understood as a negative theologian, but I would possibly, maybe myself, determine him not in such a didactic Dionysian sense of a negative apathetic theologian, though he most certainly is. But he's more like a negative mystic, because it's a very personal form, this thing. It's very much, how do I speak to the laity about this? How do I speak to my novices about this early on? This notion of clearing away, of getting away from what we don't know, of what we don't need, of basically coming to understand that what we know is only from negation in terms of what we don't know. You just keep pushing away. We don't really know the fragmentation, because that's split off from the oneness. And in heading back to the oneness, we push all things away that are even spatial and temporal. However, we may come to think that this notion of clearing ourselves, of clearing everything out so that we can have an internal purgation, we may come to think, right, good, I'm clearing away. I've got rid of my car, I've got rid of my possessions, now what? We may come to think that it has some sort of end, that there's some sort of terminus where you finally get rid of your favourite book and then God descends and you go, oh, I finally did it. Where we finally got rid of everything we don't need and there's nothing left in ourselves to renounce. Eckhart is emphatic in making it clear that we should constantly be pronouncing, confessing, and purging everything from us, and that there will be no end to this process. There is no such thing. Now, in making the mistake that there may be a point where everything we need to get rid of will be gone, that there will be a point where we are literally perfect, the mistake we're actually making is not simply one of pride and arrogance, but we're actually putting ourselves in the place of God, whereby we would be declaring that at a certain point we can be perfect. The only thing which is perfect is God, thereby that can never happen, right? We would be declaring that we would be one. We would be focusing too much on our worldly actions as opposed to our action as a being. Now, and this is a huge thing for Eckhart, and I believe personally it's one of the reasons that he got in a lot of trouble. Eckhart states in his Talks of Instructions that people should not worry so much about what they do, but rather about what they are. Now, for me, this is to do with, we could take in a commandment. We could take in a commandment. For instance, thou shalt not kill. Seems very simple. Most people aren't out there killing. But when we look, when we read this in a Dionysian sense, in the symbolic sense of what it is to kill, we could say that many people are often killing in their heart. Now, that's not to say that people have sincere desires to literally kill other people, but many people might have an internal desire to say, God, I really hope that person doesn't get their job. I really hope that person doesn't have a good day. I really hope, you know, there's still this vindictive, hateful nature within us. And so in the sense that Eckhart is talking about, we need to focus not on what we do, but rather what we are, is the acts themselves may be sort of the external act of good, but when we enter into this esoteric, what's going on inside, now we need to focus on what we are, because if what we are isn't actually conducive or mirroring the acts themselves, then have we truly gotten rid of anything at all? And it's in this sense that we see that there is a focus on the acts themselves being in connection to the soul, as opposed to the external world. You know, in Spanner, we can connect Eckhart here most emphatically with esoteric value of something hidden or deeper, inner work. And it is this inner life, for this internal life for Eckhart, which should be trained to keep God present within us at all times, a striving to love, which is allowing itself to be called up once again in what we don't know, to know by what we don't know. Any element of this fragmentation within the world will always carry us away into the wrong places, because we're then looking forward into the world and not backwards to the oneness. All fragmentation is a singular completion. It would be an error of, we're done, we finally got rid of enough, and this is the thing that we should do. And this, by its very definition, is for Eckhart and others not what God is. God is not done here on earth, right? Any singular fragmentation which we focus on is a completion. And actually, there's another controversial place and one of the places that many traditionals might disagree with Eckhart. Eckhart goes so far in his day in the 13th century to say that those who constantly need to receive God via external things, one after another in many diverse ways, whether it's certain books, certain places, certain people, these people who need this constant reaffirmation of what are very much fragmented things for Eckhart, they don't actually possess God. Because for such people, says Eckhart, the least thing in the fragmentary world can impede them. You know, if they suddenly don't have access to one of these fragmented little, oh no, I have to read that book, I have to speak to that person to get close to God, then all of a sudden they find themselves taken away from God. So they're trying to look back to the oneness by looking forward to a singular fragmentation. Now, of course, you can see that when Eckhart, as I said right at the beginning in the biographical section, when he's talking to laity about this, it's a pretty risky thing to say to laity who are very much needed to come to mass and read the Bible, etc. So once again, that would be a distinction between acts and being. If we constantly go in towards the fragmentary, which in themselves are sort of these worldly acts, and we're not focusing on what we are, who we are, our actual being, the divine spark, which is the seat of the intellect, which is miles away from all of those singular things. You know, it's our being ourselves, which is grown from the will of God, not our worldly body. Now, let's talk about a few more things where Eckhart would get in trouble. This is still from his talks of instruction. Now, it's a section from the Talks of Instruction, which is literally titled, How the Temptation to Sin Always Aids Our Progress. Now, you could already see, in terms of the institutional side of the church and dogmatics, that even reading this statement could easily be taken the wrong way. And this is probably the beginnings of why Eckhart, even from those early days, got in a lot of trouble, and it's these reasons I think that Eckhart still is probably looked upon suspiciously, especially if you're going to write something called How the Temptation to Sin Always Aids Our Progress. And the point that Eckhart is making, which is taken up by Steiner and Gurdjieff at a later date with this notion of doing the work of friction, is that even internally seeing these sins, seeing these temptations, seeing these habits and vanities of the fragmented reality, which we are prey to within ourselves, we can begin to actually alter something from them, from within ourselves. If we have no temptation, no fuel to use, then where are we even going to move? If we sit and we think, yeah, I'm a good person, I've just got to keep doing my little things and I'm fine. Well, we're not making any progress. If none of our habits, our temptations, if we can't see them and work with them and grind them down, then we're not making any progress. We're not moving anything away. We've found a certain amount of fragmented reality, which is we're comfortable with, and it's an act of pride to think that we're done. So in the sense that the temptation to sin, and you know, sinful habits, you know, Eckhart would say that they aid us. It's in this case that there's something to use. So it's Eckhart would state, well, it's not being tempted to sin, which is sinful, but consenting to sin. So when vice is stimulated, it gives us a struggle which rewards us with virtue. So to move forward, to have something to move away, have something to push away, which is itself its sin or a habit or a vice, well, that vice has to be there. So it's sort of a double bind, which is very difficult. But in the sense that we've ever got to the point where we think, well, I don't have any vices, I never sin, that's the gravest error we could make, because you're saying you're God at that point. You're saying you're done. Now, in relation to, more emphatically, esoteric Christianity, there's a section within Eckhart's Talks of Instruction, once again, section 23, entitled On Inner and Outer Works. Now, of course, everything we've been talking about, the reason why I feel we should focus on this section itself, and it's only a few pages, and I'll put them in the notes, the notion of an inner and outer work, once again, leans on a loose synonym on the difference between our individual wills and God's will. There is one work for Eckhart which is right and proper to do, and that is the eradication of the self. The inner work, and quite strangely, the inner work of ourselves is to almost get rid of a certain inner work of egoism. And there is one work, of course, which is wrong to do, which is to bolster that ego in relation to fragmentation. And so from this, the inner and the outer work, the notion that the only act Eckhart sees is just is the one which is concerning how we are being, which in itself has to be back towards the oneness as creatures of creation who are understanding that the creator is still within the essence of that creation as that divine spark. And however great this production and perturbation of the self may be, you know, within us in our little inner lives, we still need God to complete it for us. So it's still a submission. Our perfection is only made perfect. Our eventual possible perfection in heaven is only made perfect when God humbles us through ourselves. It's quite odd in this respect that Eckhart makes it clear then that it is at our lowest where we find the deepest ground of humility, where the highest point of elevation and human perfection is found. So the deeper and lower we go in the sense of realizing just how sinful and wretched and passion-filled we are is actually the highest we are. So the more we engage with, look how sinful, look, what do I do with these sins, these habits, these vices, these virtues, where we seem that we're actually our lowest, which is actually the deepest ground of our humility. It's actually our highest because we've cleared away as much as we can with regard to allowing God in. It's a strange reciprocal relationship there. The inner work is like a returning to a zero, a becoming nothing, and it's in the sense that in this pure purgation of the self to become nothing, you can allow the most in, an opening of divine nothingness which allows God to enter into our lives from this position. So the inner and outer work have this strange reciprocal relationship of going down to nothingness to allow actually the most divine fullness. This is in relation to another notion where Eckhart takes up the notion of the new man, which I'll talk a bit about in later talks, and transforms it into the title of his work called On the Noble Man. And there are stages for Eckhart in terms of us becoming the inner new or noble man. So many people would say that when you're baptized, the sacrament of baptism allows for the possibility of becoming the new man. Now, the stages for Eckhart and the stages... for Eckhart are often the things most spoken about, and I'll get to why I don't really feel it's all that helpful. I'll say that now. The reason, so that in a little bit I'm going to talk about these four stages, different similarity, identity, and like a breakthrough, these four stages, which is a very mature Eckhartian system. And it's just too systematic for me with regard to Eckhart, because he would be very much a keep coming back to who you are. You know, he wouldn't want this, what stage are you at? I don't think he's going to really say that, and it's very—it's in the sense of talking to laity. He's not going to, he's not very much a bureaucratic mystic in the sense that he's going to start, giving out boxes to tick. Have you made it to difference? Have you made it to similarity? But anyway, there's these four stages. The first stage is achieved when we live according to good and holy people. When we imitate, we're still leaning and clutching at fragmentation and things of the world, but these things that we take from are good. So we're trying to imitate people. We're still caught up in the things of the world. We're still caught up in fragmentation, but we can't fully make that full leap yet. But in the sense that we interact with fragmentation, we're doing so in a good way. Secondly, we move away from these external images, and we begin to turn our back on the world and internally turn our face towards God, a move of pushing away, and I'll clarify these stages soon. And then thirdly, we withdraw from notions of comfort and of warmth. We share concerns and fears, and we remove ourselves as much as possible. So even if the greatest worldly power came up to us and said, here's the entire world, much like Jesus's temptation in the desert, we would not wish to, because we now have an emphatic connection to God. And the fourth stage is such that the love between us and God becomes so deep that we are prepared to take upon ourselves any trial, temptation, or suffering in the name of the Lord. And then the fifth stage, we live altogether at peace within ourselves, overflowing with unknowable wisdom. And then the sixth stage, we are stripped of our own form and self and transformed by God's paternity within us and become oblivious to the temporal world, changed fully into the image of the divine. And this is eternal peace and the end of the inner man and becoming the eternal new man. So we can see that what is the basis and foundation of the inner or noble man for Eckhart relates back to the Gospels. And the new man is he who is a seed that the Lord has planted, and he seeks to manifest himself. And as you can see through those six stages, you're getting rid of, you're negating, pure apophatic theology. The reason I find them not all that helpful for Eckhart is, of course, where you have this fifth stage where he mentions the fact that, well, you'll have this unknowable love of God, and that's great. That's great. But it's like a Wittgensteinian language problem of someone mentioning that, but if you haven't got there, then you don't know it. So I don't think Eckhart maybe would focus on these in his sermons to the laity in that esoteric sense of how we can actually progress as people, because it's not all that helpful for us. And then when we move through to the the maturation of this, we move through to four phases of, and I will, these will all definitely be put in the notes, the four phases, four stages of connection between the soul, and also I will cite, which I didn't hear the citation where I got these from, because these descriptions are very finicky and I wanted to get them right. The four phases of the connection between the soul and God, which is the unification of soul and God, is the ultimate aim in a way. And they're described in Eckhart's mature teachings. Dissimilarity. Well, there's four and then four. There's three and four. It's very, very, very strange. Dissimilarity, resemblance, identity, and breakthrough. So in the beginning, God is all and the creature is nothing. In the end, the soul is above God. Risky from Eckhart. Detachment is what propels this process. So you have an itinerancy, an itinerancy, which is threefold. Detachment, release, dehiscence, and then which are the three movements, and then four stages. So the three movements are detachment, releasement, and dehiscence. And then the four stages, dissimilarity, similarity, identity, and then another dehiscence. And so you move from the movements into the stages, and that it's all very much intermingled as far as I'm concerned, but difference. All beings are only empty emptiness. They are complete emptiness, not little or petty. Unlike beings who get existence as a derivative, God possesses being intrinsically. There is utter emptiness beyond God. God is the being of things. The noble man is detached as he goes through the world, conscious that things are full of God and that they are nothing without him. So the first sense is an understanding of detachment from the world, an understanding that all that you are comes from something which is completely detached. Once again, oneness, fragmentation. You're in your fragmentation. The essence of the possibility of you being a thing at all, the being at all, is in relation to the creator, who is of course the creator of creation. Moving through to similarity from this is really the first stage of difference, of moving away from and detachment. Similarity, man recognizes himself to be an image of God when he becomes separated from the singular individual objects and linked to the universal. So he goes through to that being, and as we've seen, how do you enter into this being? You do so through the intellect and allowance, and you push things away to allow God into the space. You clear a space to allow God. So the Son, who is the Father's image, engenders himself into the unattached soul. So the soul has become detached from the things of the world. It's in that open space that the Son is then engendered and reveals a divine likeness and an integration. Thou must be in him and for him, and not in thee and for thee, an image. You can move through to three, identity. And it's simple to misinterpret Eckhart's many assertions on the similarity of God and soul. And what we need to make clear with regard to identity is it's not a case where we are literally God, nothing more than the activity of God and the becoming of man. God is now totally interiorized at this point. He is no longer outside of man. Given this, it makes sense that claims like the being and nature of God are mine, Jesus enters the castle of the soul, the spark in the soul is beyond time and space, the soul's light is uncreated and cannot be created. It takes possession of God without mediation. The core of the soul and the core of God are one. What can we do with these? Well, it's one of these problems where if you're not in that subjective mystical state, what can you really do with them? And then four, a breakthrough. For Meister Eckhart, being identified with God is still insufficient, and giving up everything without giving up God still isn't giving up anything. Man must exist without reason. None, not even God, must he seek. It's almost like a pure being, like pure creation. A thinking like that sends man into the wilderness before God, the dark night of the soul, the symbol of the desert. Have you got it in you to break through to God in such a sense that you there isn't even reason? And Eckhart believed that only when a creature invoked God did he truly exist as God. So Eckhart refers to Godhead as the source of all things that are not of God, God conceived as creator. The Godhead and God are separate as heaven and earth. The Son is not the soul any longer. The soul has become the Father, giving birth to God as a divine being, sort of like an emanation. God would not be God if I were not. Okay. Thus, the breakthrough outside of God is where detachment comes to an end. When we properly interpret it, this thought is really Christian, since it allows the believer to follow the path of Christ's cross. It's complete bearing of the cross, an entry into that. And these four stages basically allow us eventually to reach beyond God, a process of worldly detachment, of letting Him in, of complete internalization, and then of this strange nothingness, where all that can be is pure being, which is understood as the oneness. And Eckhart has cleared conceptions of God really in the relation of that oneness. So the four stages, however, even though we've got stages, and this is why I wanted to include this, because it's the mature Eckhart, but I don't think it's always that helpful, because the four stages are described by Eckhart then as not progressive. We don't reach them as different stages of life. Rather, we're busy with all four stages all the time. It's a path of renunciation. And Eckhart actually coins a word for this, which is Begenschreitenheit, a process of renunciation where one dies to the self and one becomes one with God. But this is happening all together. It's intermingled. And then the three movements are related of detachment, releasement, and dehiscence are related to the four stages. So between dissimilarity, between dissimilarity and similarity, we reach detachment. Between similarity and identity, we release. And then between identity and dehiscence, we reach a pure dehiscence. And that's why, because it suddenly becomes so systematic. There's been these years and years and years of Eckhart giving his sermons to laity, to novices, in the sense of where do we really just begin with this simplicity of the oneness and the fragmentation. And then he goes into this maturity of the stages. And for me, it's just too bureaucratic for him. And I don't think it's... But I wanted to include it because it is his mature work. And of course, he probably... it's doubtful that he ever finished his corpus with understood in relation to probably the stress he was under with respect to the Pope. But I will give an overview of the Eckhartian approach just before closing up here. I begin with that oneness. Begin with the oneness absolutely underlies everything for Eckhart, because in all things, in literally all things, of course, they could creature, world, etc. Everything which is fragmented has to have come from the oneness which is beyond all things. But that oneness, as we learnt from Pseudo-Dionysius, is in its essence always oneness, even in its fragmentation. So it's in its sense of the fragmentation in the manner of the divine spark, that the inherent fertility of the Father, as within the essence of that oneness, gives birth to the Son within us, which our intellect, as the higher seat within our own internal micro-hierarchy, mirroring other hierarchies, symbolically speaking, can communicate with God by allowing the Word in. But by allowing the Word and Christ to be born within us, we have to clear a space. So it's detachment, allowance, move away fragmentation, growth towards oneness, move away more fragmentation, growth towards oneness, to the point where, if we do very well, we will eventually end up in being able to recognize these stages and end up possibly, very unlikely to be honest, in that breakthrough stage where we're quite literally bearing our cross for Christ without any reason other than being the pure being as creation, becoming a complete nothingness. That is Meister Eckhart. And I think I will put some of the shorter excerpts from the sermons so you can get a feel of how he was talking to his laity within the notes. But and I'll of course cite the text used here, but that's Eckhart, and it's all to do with the detachment and a very practical notion moving from Pseudo-Dionysius of how we use apophatic theology individually as individual souls. And I think it's one of the most beautiful ways to appreciate how God is born within us in that esoteric hidden sense. Thank you all very much, and I'll see you all in the next talk.